This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we gather to talk about what's on our minds. We greet our friends. We figure out what's going on in the world of politics, or just want to figure out what we're going to have for lunch. These are the main streets that we gather and meet people, and this is sort of our virtual main street. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and my first guest today is a familiar voice on Main Street, Randy Kay. She is a self-care coach, and we have aired essays that she has written for us, and now we air excerpts from her podcast. Randy, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
We have you in today because you have put out a new booklet that is helping people want to like themselves a little bit better. It's called Cultivating Self-Love. Where did the idea for this come from?
Well, I talk a lot about self-care, so these tangible things that we can do to tend to ourselves and to make sure we're being taken care of by ourselves. And one of the underlying things of that is this concept of self-love, because if you don't love yourself, where's the motivation going to come from to take care of yourself? And so, and a lot of my clients and people that reach out are just, or even just random people, when we talk about self-love, it's just like, well, how do you do that? Do you just like think to yourself, I'm just going to love myself, and then boom, you can do it? Like, it's this weird kind of not very solid thing that you can just do. And so I figured that I would put something together to share some thoughts on self-love, what that actually can look like, and how to start bringing it into your life. And I say that in the book, I say that self-care is a vehicle for self-love. And so practicing self-care is part of how you cultivate that self-love. And then I go into some examples.
I know that self-love does not have one concrete definition, but that doesn't mean there can't be some examples of things that are self-love and things that feel like they could be self-love, but maybe aren't in the long term. You want to give us at least just a few examples here?
Well, I think first and foremost, self-love is having that inner love for yourself. And so you can look yourself in the mirror, and instead of all these criticisms you throw in your thoughts, you can actually be like, hi, how are you? I love you. And you can truly see yourself instead of these filters that we look through or compare ourselves to and things like that. Okay. So self-love is kind of having that true love, like how you would look at your child or, you know, one of your loved ones. You have that same feeling towards yourself.
Right. And not that many people do that. You look in the mirror and you're like, oh, bags under my eyes and I can't have a haircut.
Exactly.
And what did I eat yesterday? And
why
don't I exercise enough?
Like a bunch of different chatter. But I would say that it's in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't think that they love themselves, but if you can work through all that gobbledygook, you can see that it is there, even if it's just this little glimmer. There is love already there that that can grow.
Mm-hmm. What are some actions that might be sort of manifesting out of when we're not really treating ourselves with love? Like, can it affect our diet, our exercise, our sleep?
Yeah, it affects everything, I think. You know, I was having a conversation with myself just this morning.
Do you have different accents when you do?
Sometimes. Sometimes I do. I've been watching a lot of British baking shows, so some of those dialects are coming out. But no, there's a way of eating that I feel like my body prefers, and I've just totally been ignoring it lately. And I haven't been feeling well as a result. Like today I was just like cranky and sluggish, and I'm like, why am I feeling this way? Oh, it's because I just totally discarded how my body likes to be fed. And so my act of self-love is to be like, okay, I hear you, Randy. I love you. Like, let's go have a salad or something, you know, or like whatever isn't crap.
Yeah, my husband says I turn into the Cinderella pumpkin if I don't eat enough produce, which I was thinking of yesterday when I wasn't feeling very well and I just wanted to eat bacon and popcorn, even though there was so much produce.
Right.
I just wasn't reaching for it.
Exactly.
So that's that's part of that. That's that recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like when you get these messages from your body, what do you do with them? Do you say, okay, I'm going to listen and bring in some of these things that I'm hearing? Or are you going to say, well, too bad, I'm just going to keep eating bacon or whatever? And, you know, like junk food, I feel like there's a time and place mm-hmm. for indulgence. And that can be self-care sometimes. But that should be the exception, especially when your body is obviously telling you something else.
Right. So. Eat a watermelon.
Yeah.
Well, your book kind of it has this section on liking yourself, and mm-hmm. it kind of struck me as an odd question that I realized I didn't really know how to answer. Do you like yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have to start there?
Well, first comes like, then comes love.
Then comes baby in the baby.
Or something. I don't know. A dog.
No.
No, but yeah, I think we kind of forget to be like, oh, do I like how I'm behaving is more so. Do I like the things that I'm doing? Do I like how I spend my day? Do I like how I responded to something? Do I like the things that I like? You know what I mean? Like
right.
You could be doing things out of habit or, you know, how you used to behave in high school or something. But is that truly what you like now? You know, so there's these kind of more superficial questions. But if you start doing things that you actually like or behaving in a way that you actually like, that's how you can tune into that love. Because a lot of us, again, are acting. It was basically another way of reframing. Do you love yourself is like, do I like these superficial things even? Can you look at what you did in the day and think like, oh, I'm proud of myself. I liked those things.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you snap at somebody, like, would you want to hang out with yourself, basically? And a lot of people don't. A lot of people are behaving in a way that they don't really like, and it's not them. But for some reason, they're acting that way.
Yeah. It's really easy to fall into these patterns and into these ruts.
Mm-hmm.
Is it helpful to try and pretend you're looking at someone else when you're looking at yourself? Like if I looked at you one day and said, wow, Randy has had a half gallon of ice cream for dinner every night for a week, I should really be concerned about that. But then if I'm the one doing that, you know what I mean? Like, is it helpful to try and pretend you're looking at someone else?
Yeah, I think that is helpful. If you can step out of yourself, and one of the journaling prompts, I think, in the book is how would you talk to a loved one? And so when you can visualize yourself as your loved one, like somebody you truly care about, how would you behave and how would you talk to that person? And most of the time, you would not even think about saying things to them that you say to yourself.
Yeah.
So.
When do you find that you struggle with liking yourself?
When things are out of alignment, like when I'm behaving in ways that are out of my values or out of what I know I want to be doing, or habits, like habits that I formed, you know, when I was going through a depression or something like that, when those things stay, even though my mental health has improved, then that's what really doesn't sit well with me. And that can start manifesting itself in body pain, in digestive issues, in all sorts of things, is when you're acting out of alignment with who you are.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes there can be that external element, like if you're having a really stressful couple weeks at work and you know that once that stress sort of goes away, you might get a little bit better. What about when there are times where it might be a whole season? I had a cousin who had to move away from somewhere where it rained all the time. I myself struggle when it's really cold. There might be a whole season where this is tough.
Yeah, and that's where self-care comes into place. So that's when, what are your daily habits and rituals that help you cope with the struggles that are going on? So with the self-care practice, it's not always going to be the same morning routine, the same evening routine, the same things that bring you joy. When you move to a new location or you have a new job, you might need to incorporate things that maybe you didn't need to incorporate before. And so that's the importance of always checking in with yourself and seeing what you need. So during this season of hardship, what do I need the most? You might value a sunlight, like a light lamp, more than you would in another location. So that's what you bring in. And then you, you know, express gratitude. You know, you do all these things to try to make that experience a little bit easier, and then trust that it is just a season, because seasons of hard times happen all the time. That's life.
Yeah.
But that's where that self-love and self-care comes in, is that you know yourself well enough to know how to adjust accordingly.
And then we have this layer of that Midwestern stoicism kind of thing to deal with, that, oh, this isn't, I can get over this by right. myself without putting in any kind of proper effort for
right.
it.
Right. And then you see how well that goes. You know what I mean? Like, there's that phrase I have, I don't know who originally said it, but I say it a lot, is if you don't listen to your body whisper, then you have to hear it scream. And I feel like over time, it's going to start screaming at you, and it's going to manifest. So if you want to apply that Midwestern filter, you do it for a while until you can't anymore. So I just try to let that go. I need help. I need community. This is an issue, mm-hmm. and there's no reason to be ashamed of it. Because we're all dealing with it. That's the truth.
We're visiting with a self-care coach, Randy Kay. She has written an e-booklet called Cultivating Self-Love, which you can subscribe to her newsletter, and she'll send you a download code for that. And the website is naturallyrandyk.com, and Randy is spelled with an I. And we are talking about self-love as a, you know, self-care, helping ourselves heal ourselves. Sometimes you got to go to a professional. Sometimes you can do some of this yourself. So much of this centers around that negative self-talk. And, it, you know, it just likes to loop itself in your brain sometimes, of like, oh, I really should exercise. Oh, I really wish I hadn't fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some tips for that? So, that's self-talk feedback.
Yeah, I mean,
get the book, sure.
Yeah, but I mean, that's going to be a lifelong journey that you have with yourself, because that negative chatter is always going to be there to a certain extent. And for me, like, it's kind of comforting knowing that, like, that I'm never going to be like perfect at self-love or self-care, because it lets me just always be okay with working on it, you know, that this is something that I'm always going to have to check in with and course correct. But one thing with negative self-talk, you can make it better, and you can start to notice it. And there's a few different things to do that. Journaling is a really great way to hear what you have to say. Just getting it out on paper and reading it back to yourself is really insightful. The other one is just start having the intention to change it. And so whatever strategy you want to have to catch yourself, you start catching yourself. And when you start noticing it, it might not change right away. But once you can counter that with something positive, or just like calm that voice down, it starts to feel more and more unnatural. And then there comes a point where you're like, ugh, I really don't like how these thoughts feel. And that can increase your motivation to change that conversation. It's like building a muscle. And so over time, it can start to feel more natural to speak positively to yourself. And those negative thoughts, like, can really feel like not at home at all. And so it's easier to be like, okay, thank you for sharing. See you later. You know? So that's kind of the nutshell version of some ways you can start countering that. Mm-hmm. But just being gentle with yourself. When you hear yourself, when you catch yourself with those negative thoughts, you can be like, okay, thank you. How about we say something different right now? Mm-hmm. And then move forward. And that's going to feel really weird at first, but it's worth it. And it can shift.
It's similar to if someone said, boy, you really stunk at this, mm-hmm. versus constructive criticism. Here is something I think you can build on. So it's mm-hmm. like constructive criticism for yourself. Is
yeah.
that a fair comparison?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's definitely a place for that.
Right.
Sure.
Because you do need to recognize if you're doing something
yeah.
that's not helpful.
Yeah. Well, I think it's with anything that comes into your path, is you can stop and be like, okay, is this serving me? Is this thought worth hanging on to, or is this thought not? Is this just ridiculous and I need to let it go?
Mm-hmm.
So you can start to just get curious with the chatter in your head.
With the journaling, and maybe this is just completely dependent on the person, but does it tend to work better if you just sort of do a free-for-all, write everything that's in your brain, free-for-all, write about marshmallows, or do you want to be answering certain prompt questions?
Yeah, I have some journaling prompts in the ebook that you can get, all related to self-love and these various topics, but I really am a fan of the free write, where you just kind of do a brain dump. If you want a prompt, you can create your own. And so if you're wondering, you know, what you should do, you know, for your job, or you have some body pain or something, you have a question that you're pondering, or why am I so hard on myself? You can write that question and then answer your own question. And it's really interesting and it can really tell you a lot, and you really have a lot of the answers within. So I like to set a timer for like 5 or 10 minutes, so you're forced to keep writing, because it's usually when you think you're done writing, it's like right after that is where the good stuff is. And you just don't edit, you don't care about grammar or whatever, and you just let it flow.
Yeah. Why is it so important to talk about ourselves?
Like with ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
So we can take our thoughts and actually put them out of our head and onto something. It's important to really know how you are with yourself so you can do something with it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's something, it's dangerous inside our brains because there's so many different influences going on. There's, you know, what we're getting from the media, what we're getting from each other, how we think that person's face looked and what they might be thinking about us, you know. All of these thoughts are constantly going in and out and in and out, and it gets really hard to know what is the truth. And even when you do have depression or anxiety, that's playing a factor too. There's chemicals in your body that are influencing how you're thinking about something.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you can have some tools to kind of sift through that and to clear the clutter, then you can actually know how you're feeling about yourself and what's going on there.
In the book, you advise people try to date themselves.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's basically just taking yourself out on a date. I wrote this book around Valentine's Day, and so there's always this, like, you know, people that are single feeling down on themselves, or their significant other didn't show them love in a silly way, or, you know, a special way. And we kind of get caught up on what defines love and how we can justify if we're loved or not. and so I was thinking, like, so many people are afraid to go out to eat by themselves. They're afraid to go to a movie by themselves. They're afraid to do anything by themselves.
Guilty, guilty, guilty.
Yeah, and I've come to really love doing things by myself, because I get to just, like, hang with myself and like, experience the world just through my own filter, and I get to meet new people and things like that. So I think there's nothing to be ashamed of for doing things by yourself, and in fact, it can be very therapeutic. And I do take myself out on dates, especially when my husband doesn't feel like doing what I want to do. Like, I don't need you. but when I was going to therapy, my therapist, I was like being really stubborn about this self-love thing or looking for a specific external love. And she's like, you know, I think you need to write yourself a love letter. And I'm like, I teach people about self-love. I don't need to write myself a love letter. I need something else to happen. And she's like, I don't know. I think you should. And I'm like, okay, thanks. And then I was really stubborn about it. And then finally I just gave in. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And I went to Barnes & Noble and read magazines and got a little treat because I like to do that as a date idea. But I was like, I'm just going to do that on my own. I bought myself flowers.
Mm.
And I wrote myself a love letter, and I just bawled. Like, it was just like really a special thing. And the kind of external love I was looking for, like, came right after that. And so it's like you have to love yourself first, like, or else you're putting too much pressure on other people, and that's never a good thing.
Well, and now you can tell yourself, too, that you're just putting yourself in the minds of your clients, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to follow good advice.
Exactly. I have no shame about being the student, for sure.
Well, Randy, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Randy Kay is a self-care coach. You can find out more on her website, Naturally Randy Kay, where you can subscribe to her newsletter and you can get a download code for her new book, Cultivating Self-Love. You can also subscribe to her podcast there. Coming up next, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Winter is a great time to cozy up with a big blanket and a book. In this week's Plains Folk essay, historian Tom Ezern helps out anyone interested in reading the plains.
On the last page of her new book, Great Plains Literature, author Linda Pratt quotes Booker T. Washington. In a speech in 1895, Washington advised his hearers, "Cast down your bucket where you are." I will admit that through the middle of the book, I got a little disgruntled. Great Plains Literature is a volume in the Discover the Great Plains series published by University of Nebraska Press. The purpose of the series is to offer short books taking up standard topics for the general reader: Great Plains geology, Great Plains Indians, and so on. A reader who consumes the series should acquire a working knowledge of all the major topics in regional history and life. I really like how the book starts out. Pratt speaks of the Great Plains in lyric terms as a place sharply defined by its geography and history and absorbed in telling its stories. She recognizes, she says, the need for the open horizon and writes, "One of the enchantments of the Great Plains is that once you have seen them, you will always know when you are there." Over the next few chapters, she works through and reflects thoughtfully on works that most of us who think and read a lot about the Great Plains would recommend to you. The chapter on Native Voices takes up Black Elk Speaks, the stories of Zitkalasa, and The Way to Rainy Mountain by N. Scott Momaday. This is great company to keep. The white settlers arrive, and Pratt concentrates her attention on the works of Ole Rolvaag and Willa Cather. If Rolvaag writes the epic of pioneer settlement, she says, Willa Cather writes its elegy. I love how she says that, even though I find Rolvaag too, well, Norwegian for my taste. Then comes a chapter on the Depression and Dust Bowl where I start to fidget. There is so much discussion devoted to John Steinbeck, and frankly, I don't think The Grapes of Wrath is even about the Great Plains. Next, a chapter about novels from cities, and I just can't accept a book at St. Paul, Minnesota as Great Plains literature. Mari Sandoz is discussed, but for Capital City, not for her best book, Old Yule. Louise Erdrich likewise is treated, but not her best book, Love Medicine. Whole states and province are absent from the survey. Only in the final pages of the book, around the Booker T. Washington quote, do I get what Pratt is trying to do. She wants to cover the obvious bases like Rolvaag and Cather, but beyond that, she wants to push the envelope. She wants to point out lesser-known works worthy of consideration, and in the end, lean forward to embrace a regional history and literature still in progress. The history of the Great Plains, she concludes, clearly has critical chapters in its story yet to unfold. So cast down your bucket in the Cimarron, the Smoky, the Belle Fourche, the Cannonball. Great Plains literature is meant to be not just a guide, but an inspiration.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, director of radio Bill Thomas shares some of his favorite poems from this year's Poetry Out Loud competition. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Max Schneider is running for Congress. The Democrat is an administrative lawyer from Grand Forks and a former legislator. He says the biggest problem in Washington today is elected officials who are unable to work together for solutions to problems. So his campaign is about working for the people of North Dakota. Schneider says in some cases that may mean supporting the president. He says he supports President Trump's rollbacks of regulations like Waters of the U.S. rule or the Dodd-Frank regulations that hindered lending to small-town banks or credit unions. He also supports strengthening the nation's military. But he says loyalty to North Dakota is bigger than one man.
Loyalty to North Dakotans means preserving access to health care, like the kind that was gained under the bipartisan success of Medicaid expansion, led by legislators like Senator Tim Mathern, who's joining us here today. It also means preserving trade agreements that provide critical export markets for our agricultural producers, and it means preserving Social Security and Medicare, programs that are absolutely essential to North Dakota seniors and so many of the people that I represent on a daily basis. And so if any of those North Dakota's priorities are threatened, I will stand up for North Dakota and work with anyone to make sure that we preserve those important things for our state.
Schneider was at one time press secretary for Congressman Earl Pomeroy. He says he never saw himself one day hoping to step into the same role, but he does hope to bring the same energy and reverence to the office as his former mentor.
No matter how busy he was, he would, if he saw a tour group of high school kids from North Dakota, he'd always stop and talk to them. And he'd give about the same speech every time. He would open up his wallet and he'd take out a little card that looked like a hotel room key. And he would say that this is North Dakota's only vote in Congress, and that he never forgot that it belongs to the people of North Dakota. And so that is the approach that I'll take as well.
Fellow Democrats Ben Hansen and John Grabinger are also running for the lone congressional seat, as well as Republicans Tom Campbell and Kelly Armstrong. Sitting Republican Congressman Kevin Cramer is leaving the House to run for a seat on the U.S. Senate. And beneficial, that's how National Weather Service hydrologist Alan Schlug describes the snow we've had over the last few days.
I don't think anybody that's out there shoveling today is going to really like the idea of calling this beneficial.
However, Schlug says this has been a helpful event for agriculture and for the environment.
Because prior to coming into this weekend, we were widely well below normal for both snowfall received and snowpack retained on the countryside. So the current snowfall that we've gotten, there's been nothing in it that is alarming.
Schlug says generally northern, central, and western North Dakota were about 2 inches of moisture behind normal.
That's a large deficit.
But Schlug says in this one snow event,
we've probably got 1 to 1.5 inches across very large areas. And in that sense, that's going to go a long ways in making up that soil moisture deficit.
That is, if it all goes into the ground, but Schlug says he hopes not all of that goes that way.
Because we also need some water to hit our surface water system, fill up our streams, fill up our rivers, and across western North Dakota, especially our wetlands and our cattle ponds, the dugouts and stuff like that, that are common across western North Dakota. So it'd be really nice to see the, kind of that water split up between all those various needs.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Bill Thomas. He is a judge oftentimes at the Poetry Out Loud competition. This is where students across the state compete performing poetry for a chance to go compete at nationals, an event that's been happening since 2006. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, the students were really good this year.
Yeah? Yeah. There were about 20 students, and I assume you've been doing this for a few years. Would you... Can you kind of weigh in on, does it seem like it's just getting better every year?
Yeah, that the certainly the performances are just really were outstanding this year. And this is more schools, I think, than they've ever had.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, that's nice.
Yeah, no, if it gets too much bigger, they might have to split into an East and West division.
Right at Jamestown.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, what stands out in your mind for the performances from this year?
The poems, I mean, the thing is they're not doing their own poetry. They're doing poems that were written by somebody else, you know, a recognized famous poet. They have to pick one from before the 20th century. So there's old poems in here. And the understanding of the meanings of these poems that they exhibit in order to give a good reading they have to really understand the poem. Mm-hmm. And boy, that some of these poems are complex and subtle, and when they get it right, it really does send shivers up your back when you're sitting there in this big crowd in the Heritage Center, you know, watching them. It's something.
Well, you are a poetry lover, of course, so your ear is kind of tuned. I will admit here that I don't know that I would have the right skill set to judge poetry.
Well, I will say you can tell when they get it right because everybody kind of goes, ah, in the audience.
Mm, okay.
So, yeah.
Well, let's hear from some people.
Yeah. So as I was walking in before the competition even began, I saw two people coming in. One looked like a high school student. The other looked like maybe the teacher because usually they come with a teacher who coaches them. And so I went up and spoke to them, and here they are from Northwood High School.
I'm Tammy Lawrence. I'm Cassie Rostvet.
And what's your roles?
I am her prompter. I'm actually her mother, too, and here to support her.
And I will be reciting poetry today.
So what did you think when your daughter said, like, oh, I'm going to memorize a poem and recite it?
Well, it's something that she's always enjoyed doing. She's always been an avid reader. She loves literature. She loves classic literature especially. So I thought, well, yeah, that sounds like a thing that you would love to do. So I encourage her to do it.
So how does it work in your school?
Everyone in our classes have to memorize poems. And then we do class competitions. And then the winners of the class competitions go on to a school-wide competition.
And how do they stage the school-wide competition?
The whole school is there in our gym, and then the top eight are sitting in chairs, and they each just take turns going up to the mic and doing their poem.
And you were the top winner.
Yes.
So what poems did you consider, and what poems did you decide to memorize?
Well, my poem is called John Lennon, and I just decided to do it because I love the Beatles, and I don't know, it really just interested me.
John Lennon by Mary Jo Salter. The music was already turning sad. Those fresh-faced voices singing in a round. The lie that time could set its needle back and play from the beginning. Had you lived to 80 as you'd wished, who knows? You might have broken from the circle of that past, more hours than yours, never even sure which was the truest color for your hair. It changed with each photographer. We claimed you for ourselves, called you John and named the day you left us, spun out like a reel, the last broadcast to prove you'd lived at all. An end to hope itself. It isn't true. And worse, does you no justice if we call your death the death of anything but you. It put you in the headlines once again. Years after you'd left the band, you joined another. Of those whose lives in breaking link all memory with their end. The studio of history can tamper with you now, as if there'd always been a single track chance traveled on, and your discordant voice had led us to the final violence. Yet, like the times when I, a star-crossed fan, had cataloged your favorite foods, your views on monarchy and war, and gaily clipped your quips and daily antics from the news. I keep a loving record of your death. All the evidence is in. Of what and to what end, it's hard to figure out. Riddles you might have beat into a song. A younger face of yours, a cover shot, peered from all the newsstands, as if proof of some noteworthy thing you'd newly done.
And that was Cassie Rostvedt from Northwood High School. She was coached by Sarah Berger. And that was one of the longer poems. This next one I have to play is by one of the finalists. Her name is Maggie Weeks, and she's from Minot, from the Magic City campus. Her coach was Jacob Thomas. And this one seemed particularly appropriate given the weather that we've had this week.
Icebound by Walter Bargan. Sky's gray sheet spreads icy rain. Through the night we heard the branches cracking. Now they bend with the bowed ache of apostrophes. Backs to the window, sitting on the couch, we listen as the radio announces the list of schools closed. An hour earlier, I inched my way along the road, tires spinning toward the ditch. Now I read aloud to a teenage daughter who tolerates my foolishness. My claim that Lao Tzu traversed a more slippery world. With two books open on my lap, one in my hand, two on the floor, I'm surrounded by imperfect translations. A gathering chaos, something mysteriously formed, without beginning, without end, formless and perfect. She responds, "Sure, I knew that. So what?" I persist. That existed before the heavens and the earth, before the universe was born. She's ready to go upstairs and listen to the radio. I ask, what was her face before her parents were born? She answers, nothing. I ask again. She says it again. Where are the angels, knights on humble knees, the psalms of faith, the saints of daylight? She walks out of the room. I'm surrounded by thin books. How pointless to go anywhere on this day, or maybe any other. But then the time comes when there is no other way but to stand firm on ice.
Is it just me, or can you really tell which parts she identifies with in that poem?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to hear another finalist here, Kaylee Stanger.
Now I Pray by Kathy Engel. Ashen face, wool hat bobbing, the young boy's eyes dart to me. Then up at the man pulling a rolling suitcase whose hand he holds. Then back at me. His legs move as if without gravity. The man asks, "Do you know a church on the street that serves free food?" I want to say I know. That the names of churches on an avenue called America's roll out of me. I want to tell you it is temporary, their condition. Suitcase, darting eyes, seeking free food at 9 p.m. in a big city on a school night. I want to tell you I don't for a moment wonder if that is really the boy's father or uncle or legitimate caretaker. Something in the hand-holding and eyes, having watched too many episodes of Law & Order. I want to tell you I take them to a restaurant and pay for a warm meal, or empty my wallet, not worrying how offensive it might be, because in the end, hunger is hunger. I want to tell you I call someone who loves them, that there is someone, and say, "Your guys are lost, can you come?" I want to tell you I sit down on the sidewalk at the corner of Waverly and pray that all passing by, anonymous shoes marking the pavement, join in a chorus of prayer humming like cicadas in the delta. I want to tell you, the boy and the man eat food encircled by the warmth of bodies. I want to turn the cold night into a feast. I will tell you, I am praying.
Oh. Well, I know you said earlier some of the poems have to be from before the 20th century. That one, with its reference to Law and Order, probably not so much. That was by poet Kathy Engel, performed by Kaylee Stanger from Shanley High School.
Yeah, and her coach there is Brian Jeffrey, so he does a great job.
Yeah, he's been very much a champion of poetry out loud for many years. Well, who else do we
have? Emily Gilsrute, she was another finalist from Wahpeton. She was coached by Heather Woods and Christy Maurer, both had their names down, and did some great readings. This is one that goes to Last Words.
Let the Light Enter by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. The Dying Words of Goethe. Light, more light, the shadows deepen and my life is ebbing low. Throw the windows widely open, light, more light before I go. Softly let the balmy sunshine play around my dying bed. Ere the dimly lighted valley I with lonely feet must tread. Light, more light, for death is weaving shadows round my waning sight. And I fain would gaze upon him through a stream of earthly light. Not for greater gifts of genius, not for thoughts more grandly bright. All the dying poet whispers is a prayer for light, more light. Heeds he not the gathered laurels fading slowly from his sight? All the poet's aspirations center in that prayer for light. Gracious Savior, when life's daydreams melt and vanish from the sight, may our dim and longing vision then be blessed with light. More light.
Yeah, they went over well in Wahpeton and went over well in Bismarck. Yeah, so that was Emily Gilsrute from Wahpeton.
And now we are going to hear from Maria Kolb, and she is
St. Mary's Central in Bismarck, and her coach was Mary Huff, and this is a real interesting, it's kind of one of those double meaning you sort of shift back and forth ones.
Goldfish by Kun Woon. The goldfish in my bowl turns into a carp each night, swimming in circles in the day, regal, admired by emperors. But each night while I sleep, it turns into silver, a dagger cold and sharp, couched at one spot, enough to frighten cats. The rest of the furniture squats in the cold and dark, complains of being a lone man's furnishings, and plots a revolt. I can hear myself snore, but not their infidelity. Sometimes I wake with a start. Silently, they move back into their places. I have been unpopular with myself, pacing in my small square room. But my uncle said, even in a palace, you can but sleep in one room. With this, I become humble, as a simple preacher saying, I have no powers. They emanate from God. With this, I sleep soundly. Fish or no fish, dagger or no dagger, when I wake, my fish is gold. it pleases me, with a trail of bubbles. My furniture has been loyal all night, waiting to provide me comfort. There was no conspiracy against a poor man. With this, I consider myself king.
Yeah. Maria Kalb from St. Mary's Central in Bismarck doing a great job on that poem.
Boy, every one of these I've heard, I've said, well, that one clearly had to be the winner. That one had to be the winner. Someone's got to win, if you will, a competition and go on to nationals, and they even get a little bit of money for their school.
Yes, right? Yeah. The whole thing is sponsored nationally by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation, okay. And they put some money up for prizes. So the winning students get some money for their schools, and the top winner, some money for the school and some money for the student, and goes to Washington, D.C. for the national finals.
Well, who's going for this year?
Maria Modi, and she was really good. It was a competitive year, but she stood out, and she is from Fargo North, and her coach is Lori Koenig, and I always mention the teachers because the teachers make such a difference in getting these in. And this is a poem this is the main one she picked that she really wanted to do.
The Waking by Theodore Rothke. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling. What is there to know? I hear my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Of those so close beside me, which are you? God bless the ground. I shall walk softly there and learn by going where I have to go. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? The lowly worm climbs up a winding stair. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Great nature has another thing to do to you and me. So take the lively air and lovely learn by going where to go. This shaking keeps me steady, I should know. What falls away is always and is near. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I learn by going where I have to go.
Wow.
Yeah.
That one's going to stay with me.
Maria Modi from Fargo North, the top competitor, the winner of the statewide North Dakota Poetry Out Loud competition.
Well, congratulations to all of the competitors. Bill, I got a quick question for you here. You're listed as the panel in the judges, and then you flip the page in this pamphlet, and then there's accuracy judges.
Yeah.
What's the difference here?
Okay, the accuracy judge, we're looking at the reciters. You know, we're looking at them for their stage presence and their eye contact and everything and hanging on their words. The accuracy judge is staring at a printout of the poem and marks every time they stray from the text of the poem. So if they leave out a line or change a word or something, they get points off.
So this is the technical judge and the artistry judge at the Olympics.
Right, exactly.
Well, Bill Thomas was one of the judges at this year's Poetry Out Loud competition in Bismarck. Bill, thanks as always.
Okay, thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 6th. Long before North Dakota tapped its oil, there was lignite coal mining. And a century ago, the state engineer was tasked with inspecting those mines and building a report. From 1908 to 1911, lignite production increased about 15% each year. 65 mines were in operation in 1908, up to 100 by 1911. Almost 1,100 men worked at the state's coal mines in the winter of 1911, and over 300 through the summer, averaging 6 months out of the year in the mines. Each man put out a daily average of nearly 4 tons of coal, totaling almost 500,000 tons in 1911, worth about $700,000. On this date in 1912, State Engineer T.R. Atkinson inspected several coal mines near Burlington, North Dakota. He found most of the mines satisfactory, except for the Lloyd coal mine, which had very poor ventilation. In February and March of 1912, Atkinson inspected 101 coal mines, as many as 9 in a day. His work took him to 15 counties in western and northern North Dakota. Some mines he found abandoned, or with as few as 1 or 2 workers. Atkinson also noted injuries and fatalities in his report to Governor John Burke. 1911 had 18 injury accidents and 1 fatality, a man who died in a blast. Other men lost eyes, broke bones, and sustained bruises in brushes with mining equipment. Fatalities stayed at about 1 a year, but non-fatal accidents spiked from 5 to 18 from 1910 to 1911 in North Dakota's lignite mines. By 1919, the coal mining industry was dangerous enough in North Dakota that the legislature adopted a state coal mining code that created a state coal mine inspector. That position was eliminated in 1979. Now, the state's Public Service Commission regulates coal mining. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Voter turnout in this week's Texas primary could tell us something about November's upcoming midterm elections.
One of the biggest problems that the Republicans have in Texas is that they have won regularly for a quarter of a century, and their voters get more and more complacent. We're going to win this thing. We don't need to show up.
Rachel Martin is live from Dallas with the latest on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to hear from Carrie Warburg Block. She is the person who started the Earthkind company. Maybe you've seen these at Target. They're natural pest control methods, and she talks about being a female entrepreneur. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.